Hey guys, listen up. March Madness is now over, but there is still a way for you to cash in at MyBookie. If you have not signed up yet, it's not too late. It doesn't matter if you've been a player for years or you just want to jump in right now. There's lots to get down on. Hockey, basketball, just about anything. Lay down some money and score big. Join thousands of online players and start betting right now at MyBookie.ag. Here's why. Maybe you're sick and tired of getting the runaround when you ask for a payout. Not with MyBookie. Join right now. They pay fast and they do so without hassles. I'm telling you, you are wasting your time if you bet anyplace else. They even have in-game betting, so once the game gets underway, you can still get down. Join right now, and MyBookie will match your first deposit with a 50% bonus. All you have to do is use the promo code JUNGLE in order to activate that offer. Once again, visit MyBookie.ag today. Play, win, and get paid. Visit MyBookie.ag today.
Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Well, let's start with some baseball. In fact, why don't we start the program by jumping into the Wayback Machine. Let's jump into that Wayback Machine and go all the way back to March 29th, 2018. Now, to give you a taste of exactly what was going on back then, God's Plan by Drake was the number one song on the charts. Pacific Rim Uprising was tops at the box office. Gas was merely $2.65 a gallon nationwide. Oh, and Giancarlo Stanton hit a couple of home runs in his Yankee debut, and this guy was a god. That was then. Fast forward to yesterday. Stanton makes his home debut in pinstripes, and let's just say it did not go quite as well. Strikeout swinging in the first, strikeout looking in the third, strikeout swinging in the fifth, strikeout swinging in the seventh, and then this in the eighth.
Now here is Romo's 1-2. Struck him out swinging. Stanton has had a forgettable day. He's been up five times. He struck out five times.
Right. Five strikeouts, five at-bats. Let's be honest. Five Ks in your home debut is awesome if you're a pitcher, but terrible if you're a batter. I mean, that's a brutal way to open your account at home. But the platinum sombrero was not even the worst part of it. In fact, not even nearly the worst part of it. Not even close. To me, the worst part was the booing. Yes, Yankee fans were booing Stanton in his home debut on April 3rd. In a game, they won by 7 runs, and they were booing him. It is simultaneously the most absurd and most predictable thing ever. Yankee fans gonna Yankee fan. And I've got one question. What the hell is wrong with you? No, let me rephrase that. What the hell is wrong with you losers? Now, I don't use that term lightly. I'm not looking to come in here and call anybody a loser. But if you booed Stanton last night, you are a loser. There are no two ways around this. If you boo a guy in his home debut, you're a loser. Now, I'm not going to try and tell you this guy had a great game yesterday. He didn't. He had a horrible day. Probably his worst day ever. But honestly, the way Didi Gregorius played, it didn't matter, which is the whole point. Stanton is 0 for 5, 5 punch-outs, and the Yankees still hang 11 on the opposition. So that's not a reason to boo. That's a reason to party. I thought Yankee fans, and I'm not grouping all of you under this one umbrella, but I thought Yankee fans were supposed to be great baseball fans. Because if they really were great baseball fans, they would know days like that happen for Stanton. They would know he averages more than a strikeout per game. That's a small price to pay for a guy who can hit 60 home runs and win the MVP. But if you boo him, you don't come across as a great baseball fan. You come across like an entitled loser. And the worst part is, I'm guessing these clowns would probably justify it by saying something like they felt like they had to keep up their reputation as Yankee fans. Or better, they were doing it to make him a better player. You know, like, I didn't want to boo the guy, but I felt like I had to, that it was my job in order to inspire him to greatness. If anything, he should be thanking me because I'm making him better. Philly fans booed Mike Schmidt, one of the greatest third basemen of all time. And not just once, by the way. Ask them why they did that. They'll tell you, because we wanted to make the guy better. They'll tell you they're the reason Schmidt is in Cooperstown, not Schmidt himself. So maybe Yankee fan is just trying to get Stanton his bust. Or maybe you're a loser. And you know, classy guy that he is, he was practically thanking them for killing him afterwards. Quote, "I was awful today. You put up a performance like that, you should get some booze." End quote. Guy said, "Gee, I totally respect your opinion, but I agree to disagree. You may have been terrible yesterday. I mean, you were. But people booing you were even worse. You were trying to do your job. And if I had to guess, it's probably a pretty good chance that you were pressing because it was your debut in front of them. You were trying to make a good impression in your home debut. I mean, that'll happen. Nights like that will happen to almost anybody who's not Ted Williams or Tony Gwynn. The people who booed you are the ones who deserve to be booed. Look, the guy had two home runs in the season opener on Thursday. And when he did that, they were clearing space in Monument Park for him. Less than a week later, they're booing the same guy at home. It's freaking April 3rd. Listen, I get it if we're in August and he's been dogging it all year long. But if you're going to boo the guy, boo him based on effort, not on results. This early in the season, if we're more than 100 games in and this guy's not running out ground balls and he's waving weakly at bad pitches, then go ahead and crush him. But April 3rd, it's April freaking 3rd. In other words, what I'm saying is settle the hell down. And if you're booing this guy, man, get a grip, get a life, get a life. April 3rd. And Yankee fan, if you're going to come in here and say, "Rome, you just don't get it," I'm going to agree with you. That's my whole point. I just don't get it. Because you're deifying the same guy a week ago. My guest is Dana White. Dana, good morning. Good to have you back. How are you?
I'm great, buddy. How you doing?
Dana, I'm great. It's nice to have you back. Let me start with the card, Dana, for UFC 223. It had a pretty significant change. In fact, Dana, people thought that it was some sort of April Fool's joke when it was announced that Tony Ferguson was pulling out of the fight and being replaced by Max Holloway. How far from a joke was that for you? And Dana, did you have any laughs about that?
No laughs. I got the call early in the morning, got up, went to work, spent Easter at the office, you know, trying to get this thing figured out. But, you know, it was obviously a low of all the lows, but then we ended up leaving on a huge high. Being able to pull off a fight, you know, with the UFC featherweight champion stepping up on 6 days' notice. This guy's on a 12-fight win streak, hasn't lost in 5 years, has the most stoppages in UFC featherweight history. And people think that, you know, this is the grappler, you know, the grappler versus striker. You know why they think that? Because Holloway hasn't been taken down in 4 years. So to be able to put a fight like this in, it turned my Easter around.
Dana White joining us. Dana, I want to talk about that matchup, but to the point you just made. Now, Ferguson tore his LCL off his bone while on the media tour. So can you take me through the process? I mean, what happens from the time that you receive that injury news to then going to find a replacement, and not just a warm body replacement, but the featherweight champ, Max Holloway?
Yeah, it was. So we had heard a couple days before he tweaked his knee, but he says, "I'm good. No matter what, I'm taking this fight." So then he went in and tried to roll around. And he said, "You know what? I'm going to get an MRI." Goes in, and I got the call Sunday morning that the MRI came back bad, that it was actually his LCL was torn from the bone. And normally that's not a surgery. You know, you just need like 5 or 6 weeks to let it heal up. He's actually going to need surgery. So it was the worst type of injury you could get. So that's Sunday morning, a week before the fight, and me and the matchmakers go into the office and, you know, you stare at the wall for hours and start throwing names around. And, you know, we came up with Max Holloway. We called him. He wanted the fight. Also, Brian Ortega accepted the fight too, the number one ranked guy in the world at 145. So we had a couple of great options. You obviously offer it to the champ first. The champ accepted, and here we are.
We're talking Dana White. So he takes that fight on very, very short notice. And as you point out, Dana, he's putting a streak on the line. Now, there are numerous reports that Holloway's got a lot of weight to lose before Friday's weigh-in. Do you have a sense of how much weight he has to lose? And is there any part of you that's worried that he might not make it?
No, not at all. I mean, I think, you know, everybody likes to sensationalize stuff. At the end of the day, he usually cuts to 145. He's cutting to 155, mm-hmm. 10 pounds less. So I have no, when we talked to him too that day, they felt very comfortable with making the weight.
The Daily Jungle today brought to you by Fan Exchange. Are you thinking about buying tickets to your favorite sports, concert, or theater event? We're coming up on the weekend. Lots of good things going on. Maybe you want to experience a basketball game courtside rather than on your couch. How about banging on the glass at the hockey game? NHL regular season coming to an end soon. Then head on over to FanExchange.com for a safe, easy, and reliable experience. Tickets purchased on FanExchange are always guaranteed, and there's no getting to the gate and then worrying about getting in. Whether it's the NBA, Major League Baseball, WrestleMania, Coachella, or a Broadway musical, FanExchange gets you closer to the action. Find the very best seats at the best prices at FanExchange.com. Use the promo code Rome, and you'll get 50% off the service fees on your next purchase. Fan Exchange, we have tickets. Dana White, my guest. All right, so the weight cut, it may or may not be a thing, right? But the thing that is a thing, of course, is he's going to have to deal with Khabib once he gets in the cage. Khabib is a monster, and when he gets opponent to the ground, and he can do some real damage. On UFC 223 Embedded, he said he knows Holloway is a great striker, but, quote, I am going to take him down and smash him. So how does Holloway go about defending against that?
Yeah, for people that don't know, Khabib is undefeated. He's 25-0, and it is impossible to go undefeated in this sport. This guy is the real deal. He's a beast. But funny, I think that Holloway is very underrated. Like the stats that I told you in the beginning, you know, the guy hasn't lost in 5 years, and his last loss was a decision to Conor. You know, Conor's out there knocking everybody out at 155. Holloway went to a decision with him. He's got the most stoppages in featherweight history, and he's an absolute beast, and I think he's completely underrated. But at the end of the day, Khabib is a monster. It's just when you break this fight down, you look at the stats, it's awesome.
Hey, Dana, what about that? Let's flip that thing on its head for a minute. I mean, obviously it's a huge challenge for Holloway to accept a fight like this on short notice, but how much does that change things for Khabib with his opponent changing from Ferguson to Holloway?
Absolutely. I think that he has to worry more about the striking. I think that, you know, when this thing did go to the ground, Tony's so good on the ground, but I think that Holloway is too. The problem is Holloway never gets there. He hasn't been taken down in 4 years. Think about that. Holloway has not been taken down in 4 years because he doesn't allow himself to get taken down. And in his last fight with Jose Aldo, he literally walked right through Jose Aldo. Like he was too big and too strong for that division. And I think people are going to be surprised at how big he looks next to Khabib, too.
All right, so UFC 223.
Fight. It's an interesting fight. And obviously, if he wins, he's made it very clear he's the youngest two-belt champion. He'll hold two belts at the same time. The only guy to ever do it is Conor McGregor.
No, I was going to say that, Dana. If he wins, if he moves up and he wins on 6 days' notice and he holds two belts at the same time, where would that rank in terms of all-time achievements in UFC history?
Massive, especially since the opponent is Khabib. You know, especially, you know, the simple fact of who he is fighting and who he will do it to. And what I love about this guy, too, what I love about Holloway, like you just said, taking this thing on 6 days' notice just goes to show what a real fighter, what a real stud he is, and how much he believes in himself.
Dana White joining us. That fight's coming up this weekend. So, Dana, they're fighting for the lightweight title. Conor McGregor currently holds that belt. He will no longer hold that belt after Saturday. Have you had conversations with him about that? Do you have a sense about how he feels about losing that belt?
Yeah, obviously he's not thrilled about it. But, you know, Conor is a really smart kid. He understands. He hasn't fought in a year and a half. So, and he's talking about coming back in September. You just can't let the division sit around like that. It's not fair to everybody else. And, you know, I think Conor gets that.
Hey, Danny, he is talking about, and you said it best, talking about coming back in September. In your opinion, how interested is he? I mean, is that a matter of, yeah, I might be interested, or is he really serious about fighting this fall?
Well, we've been talking a lot lately, so I think the fact that division is moving on has lit a fire under him, and he wants to fight.
Do you think he will?
I do.
Dana White joining us. Dana, as we talked about before, you're a boxing guy. We know this. What do you make of Canelo Alvarez pulling out a next month's fight against Triple G and the reason he's given for it?
What was the reason he gave? It happened yesterday when I was jumping on a plane in New York.
Yeah, he's not changing. He's not coming off his story. He says it's tainted beef. He's never done anything intentionally. He's never tried to do this. He never looked for an edge. He just ran into some bad beef.
I think that, I think you'd have to be consuming a ton of beef. I like Canelo, so I don't want to, dog the guy. But at the end of the day, the reason he pulled out is because I think he knew what the outcome was going to be when he went before the Nevada State Athletic Commission. And you're better to pull out than have to go through that publicly. Probably pull out. They're still going to go after him and probably fine him and suspend him, I'm assuming. But it won't be a big circus now. And I'm sure that's why he did it.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think that's all true. And this way, they also saved the fight date for Triple G. He did say one more thing, Dana, while you were traveling at that presser. He'd made the point that Triple G is afraid of him. He thinks that's part of it, that he's afraid of him. I mean, that's pretty laughable, right?
Again, I like Canelo. Personally, I like him. He's a super nice guy. He didn't win that first fight. So I don't think Triple G is afraid of him. I actually think it's horrible the way that fight was judged. And, I don't think Triple G is afraid.
We're talking to Dana White. Dana, one last thought. We can't talk boxing without talking about the possibility of Floyd fighting MMA. Now, for years, the Conor Floyd boxing match was talked about, and we thought it would never happen. And then, sure enough, it happened. Could you see something similar happening with a Floyd MMA fight? Does money talk in this situation, Dana? And could this guy really step into the cage if the money was right?
Yeah, I think yes. I didn't think the first fight was going to happen, but I'd never dealt with Mayweather. All I'd ever seen from the outside was the stuff that went on with him and Arum and how they couldn't get the Pacquiao fight done. And then once I got in and started negotiating with these guys, they're actually smart guys. They're easy to deal with, and it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. It was much easier. So, yeah, I could see this happening.
So finally, Dan, if that happens, could he beat one of your better fighters? Could he beat a quality UFCer?
Anybody can get caught on any given day, but I think it goes very badly for him.
All right, so we're less than a week into the season, and already the Shohei show has been pretty damn good. I'm talking about Shohei Ohtani. And if we are being honest, he did not have a very good spring. In fact, there was already that suggestion that instead of being the best thing ever, he may have been the most overhyped thing ever. Maybe dude could not actually pitch and hit in the majors both in this era of specialization. Because nobody can. At least that's how it looked. But now, a few games in, you can break out all the horrible Shohei puns that you want. Showtime. Show far, show good. Show many more to come. Listen, Thursday he made his debut as a batter. He singled on the first pitch he saw. Then Sunday, he made his debut as a starting pitcher. He gave up a three-runner in the second, but then he settled in. He went six innings. He struck out six. He set down 14 of the last 15, and he got the win. And then came his home debut last night. And in his first at-bat at home with two men on, this happened.
Here's the next pitch. And he lifts a high drive that's well hit into right center field. It is out of here. Shohei Ohtani, his first major league home run.
Credit KLAA Angels Radio. Best part of that home run, though. The best part was not the home run. It was not the trip around the bases. It's not how jacked he was as he rounded third. I haven't seen anybody that hyped after hitting a home run coming around third than my son Jake when he jumped ship in high school. That could knock the smile off his face. Same thing with Shohei. But even that wasn't the best part. The best part was the reception that he received when he got back to the dugout. The complete and utter lack of any reception when he got back to the dugout. The team breaks out that old ignore the home run hitter trick. And he gets in there, and for a second, it looked like he didn't really get it. Or maybe he did, and he played along. But then he went right along with it by high-fiving invisible teammates, which was hilarious. Until he finally grabbed an actual teammate, and then the whole dugout broke out. I mean, it was such an awesome moment. And you could tell how much fun they were having with it, and you could tell how much they liked him in that moment. And then Mike Trout sent him out for a curtain call. And why not? He's now become the first American League player to start a game as a pitcher and homer as a DH since 1973. And he did it in his first week in the majors. You want some more history? He's the first non-pitcher to start an opening day and then start on the mound within the first 10 games of the season in nearly a century. Babe Ruth last did that in 1919. And let's get that part of it out of the way. He might be glossed, the Japanese Babe Ruth, but he's not Babe Ruth. Nobody is. The Babe was one of the best hitters ever. The Babe would have been one of the best pitchers ever. And the Babe was fueled up on steaks, cocktails, and the ladies. So Shohei is not that. Nobody is. But he looks like he's a freaky talent. Because it wasn't just about the home run. He added two singles. He went 3-for-4. He knocked in 3 runs. He had 2 runs scored. I mean, is that any good? It's great. I can answer that. It's great. And his third hit of the game was a line drive single in the eighth that was clocked at 112.8 MPH by StatCast. That was the hardest hit ball by any Angel player so far this season. As manager Mike Socha said, quote, Shohei put on a display of the type of talent that he has tonight. He showed the power. He showed the ability to just square up a baseball. And he had a great night for us. End quote. And to me, best of all, this guy did this. He did it taking his first at-bats in 5 days. How is it possible to just lock in like that after throwing 6 innings and not taking any at-bats for a few days? I mean, I've got no idea. And I've got no idea how long it's going to last. I just know that I've got to see it myself. And that's exactly what I'm going to do this weekend. I'm going to head out to the stadium to see the Angels and the A's because this dude is putting on a show and I don't want to miss it. Thought that was just so awesome. That home run was great, and the reaction was even better. Clones, midweek, time to make a very good decision. How would you like to shop for organic groceries without paying top dollar? You can bypass those overpriced local markets and shop at Thrive Market, a revolutionary online marketplace on a mission to make healthy living easy and affordable to everyone. Great, great idea. Thrive Market is stocked with thousands of the best-selling non-GMO foods and natural products, always at 25 to 50% below traditional retail prices. They've got everything you need, whether your diet is paleo, gluten-free, vegan, kosher, and personal care products, eco-friendly cleaning supplies, safe and non-toxic beauty products, organic baby food, kids' products, and so much more. Click on a product, and you'll see things like why you'll love it, price comparisons to retail, nutritional information, and more. You can shop knowing that you are getting the very best ingredients, the most affordable prices, and that it's all safe for your family. Thrive Market's prices are already up to 50% off, and now they're giving you an extra $60 in free groceries plus free shipping. Get $60 off free organic groceries plus free shipping and a 30-day trial. Go to thrivemarket.com/Rome. That's thrivemarket.com/Rome. Great product. Do that right now. Gerard Gallant is my guest. Gerard, it's great to have you on. How are you?
I'm great, Coach. I'm great.
It's good. Good to have you. Listen, you're coming off a shootout win over Vancouver last night where you had a lead, you let it get away, you ultimately win in that shootout. First off, what's it say about your team that they find a way to grind it out after letting it slip away to a certain extent? They come back and they find a way to get it done. What did they show you last night?
Yeah, no, that's what we've done. I mean, we found ways to win hockey games where we played really good. Last night we were outstanding hockey for the first 40 minutes, and then, you know, we had a 4-1 lead. Let it slip away a little bit. We got a couple bad penalties, and then they got right back in the game, and they probably could have won that game late in the third period, but the Subban made a couple big saves for us. And, you know, then again we come back and we find a way to win in the shootout, and it's another 2 big points for us. So that's sort of the story of our year. You know, we play real good hockey, and you know, we have a chance to win every night, and a lot of those nights we're winning those games.
You know, and it keeps getting better and better. In the last few days alone, you wrap up the division. You get some good news about Riley Smith being close to returning. Now you're getting ready for the postseason. I mean, it's hard to imagine, but it's been roughly 51 weeks since you were introduced as the first head coach of the Golden Knights. I understand that you're locked in and focused on the next game and then the postseason. But if you take 1 minute and you look back, what has the last year been like for you personally?
It's been outstanding, and like you said, it's almost been a year since I was introduced as the head coach, and I was very excited when I got the opportunity to be the head coach of this hockey team, an expansion team, you know, coming to Las Vegas, the first team ever in Las Vegas. So it was exciting for me and my family, and it was a good chance to get back in the NHL right away to be a head coach, and you know, we didn't know what the expectations were going to be. I mean, obviously, we never thought we were going to win a Pacific Division Championship, but we knew we were going to have a team that was going to compete and battle hard every night. And, you know, we got on a roll early in the season. We went 8-2-2 in the first 12 games and played real well and played good hockey. So the team just grew confidence from that.
You know, Gerard, it's not just unheard of in hockey. It's unheard of in all of professional sports to have this kind of success right out of the gate. So if you had to, how do you explain it?
Well, the expansion rules are good. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, we paid a lot of money for our expansion team, but the NHL did a real good job of making the rules fair for our team to be competitive. And, you know, we went out and our management team did an unbelievable job in the expansion draft. They got some real good hockey players. And like I said, nobody expected us to be where we're at today. But I think the team came together real quick. I think players are having career years for us, and that's been the biggest difference. I mean, we got outstanding goaltending. We got eight solid defensemen that can play in any given night, and our forward line is a lot of balance up front. So we work hard, we compete hard, and everything falls in place.
Gerard Gallant joining us. You know, you've got a lot of skill. That's a given. But it seems to me it's got to be about that room, right? I mean, you can have that kind of skill, but you can't have that kind of success unless you've got amazing chemistry. So how do you go about developing that chemistry on a team where so many guys from so many different places have to come together quickly?
Well, you said it. I mean, the most important thing when the expansion draft took place was let's get some skill, but let's get some good people. And, you know, we went out there and we got some real good people. I mean, we're fortunate to get a guy like Marc-Andre Fleury, a guy like Derek Eglin. You know, there's all kinds of guys like that. Marc-Edouard Bellemare. I mean, there's character guys there that played in other teams. And all the coaches called me from the other teams and they said, you know, these guys are character players. They're not superstar hockey players, you know, some of them, but they're character guys and leadership. And that really helps our dressing room and it helps me be, you know, it helps our coaching staff a great deal because these players take care of our young guys.
Now, let me ask you about a guy you didn't mention yet that you probably would have gotten to in a second or so. You've got a lot of guys having huge years, but what about William Karlsson? He's got 43 goals, 78 points. Go back first to Saturday night when he beat San Jose's Martin Jones on a shorthanded breakaway goal by going between his own legs and scoring. What did you think when you saw that?
Well, it was pretty impressive. And to be honest with you, I don't. When he has a breakaway, I usually turn the other way when people have breakaways in our team. So I want to hear the roar of the crowd or, you know, they score the goal or not. But it was an unbelievable move. He's a confident hockey player for us right now. And for him to pull a move like that off, you know, shorthanded breakaway, a 2-2 hockey game, and to make a play like that, it just goes to show the confidence this kid has. And, you know, we know he's a good hockey player, but he's just taking advantage of all of the playing on the top line with Marchessault and Riley Smith most of the year, playing a lot of power plays, and he's showing his skill level and talent. And, you know, it's great for him. He's had a hell of a year for us.
You know, Gerard, it's almost like a rule now, but every time I have you or one of your guys on the show, I end up talking about the fan base in Vegas. When I had Ryan Reeves on the show a few weeks back, he said that when he played in Vegas for Pittsburgh, he was blown away by the fans, and now he loves playing in front of them. How would you describe then the bond between the fans and your team and how that also developed so quickly?
Well, it, like you said, it happened from the tragedy from the first our opening game. I mean, we had the unbelievable ceremony with the first responders. And I think from that night on, it hasn't stopped. Our fans have been outstanding. It's every game. I mean, I expected it to slow down a little bit. I really did. But we've had 41 home games here, and it's just been unbelievable every night. They're a big part of our group. They're a big part of our team, and they're a big part of the reason why we had such a good home record.
All right, so I know you're focused on Edmonton tomorrow night, but do you have any sense what that arena in Vegas is going to be like for that first playoff game and how much of an edge you might get from that same crowd?
I think it's just going to be it's going to double what it has been all season long, and that's going to be crazy because the guys can barely hear me now, and I'm trying to change the line. So it's going to be fun. It's going to be a great atmosphere, and we just can't wait for it.
All right. So one last thought. You said that when you were in Florida, the people who recognized you there were the French Canadian snowbirds, but now it's getting to the point in Vegas where you can have a night off and you go out for dinner, and people all come up and say, "Hey, coach. Hi, coach. What's going on?" So what's that been like for you personally?
It's been unbelievable, really. I mean, no, I didn't really expect that. I really didn't, especially this early in the franchise, you know. But, you know, we go downtown, like you said, people are recognizing you everywhere. It's obviously fun. Our organization's done a great job of putting the players out there and getting the people to know us. And we have open practices all the time. And, you know, the guys love it. The fans are there. The guys really enjoy getting out in the community. And it's really taken off.
We are joined by Ray Allen. Ray, good morning. It's great to have you on the program. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing, Jim? Thanks for having me.
Good, Ray. Great to get caught up. You know, there are a lot of things I want to talk to you about, Ray, but let me start right here. Take me back to the weekend where you were officially introduced as a member of the Hall of Fame, class of 2018. What was that moment like for you?
It was certainly a whirlwind, Jim. We came from the whole week in New York promoting the book tour, and then toward the end of the week, I get this phone call. I was actually traveling from New York to Boston, and they tell me, hey, you've been inducted into the Hall of Fame class of 2018. And then obviously, you know, Grant and Jason and Steve and Charlie Scott and Tina Thompson, some great names, some people that I looked up to and people who I came into the league with. It was such an amazing week I had, and I just feel so honored and privileged to be like able to at the end of the road say it ended up with a Hall of Fame nod.
Ray Allen joining us. You know, Ray, you mentioned that class. Like, as I look back on your journey, and this is something you've talked about in your book, you kept progressing as a player at every single level. I mean, from high school to college to the NBA, you became part of a smaller and more elite group every step of the way. Now you're in the Hall of Fame, and you go in with a class, part of a class which includes Jason Kidd, Steve Nash, and Grant Hill, among others. So what's it feel like to know that you are now part of the most elite group in basketball history?
Well, I learned a stat that said that there's maybe only 150 to 160 living Hall of Famers. So to think about how select few people that is an amazing feat. And then, you know, just to think about everybody that I came along with, to be able to go from one stage to the next and to continue to improve. I've been equated to a video game. You know, when you start one level and if you beat the guy at the end and you get to the next level, I believe we all go through that type of challenge in life where you have somebody that stands in your way and you have to learn something from them, good or bad, to be able to move on. But one way or the other, you have to improve who you are to get to the next level.
We're talking to Ray Allen. Ray, in the book, you open up by writing about the final seconds of Game 6 of the 2013 Finals against the Spurs. That was the game where you hit that legendary shot that forced the game into OT, where you eventually won it and then won Game 7. So when you close your eyes and you think about that game, what thoughts or images come to mind?
I'm glad I didn't miss.
Right.
Yeah, because most people, and this is the way I operate in life, is they're afraid to take that shot because they don't want to be the one that didn't help their team. And ultimately, you end up hurting your team if you don't take the shot. But ultimately, I think, what if I make the shot as opposed to what if I miss? And that's about everything in life. Like, you give your best to something, and then you see what the outcome may be. But for the most part, you prepare yourself so when the opportunity comes, you're ready to perform. It doesn't always go in your favor, but for the most part, you can say you gave it your all. You know, one of my favorite quotes is the man in the arena, Franklin Roosevelt. You know, just the fact that people showed up, those are the ones that count. Those are the men that stood up and were there to be accountable for.
You know, Ray, it seems to me, I get that. You're right. There's something about the man in the arena, the guys who are actually doing it. But if you take it a step further, and to the other point that I think you're making, it still takes a different breed to want that ball in the moment. And as you realize in your career, you were always that guy who wanted the ball in that situation, but not everybody does. What do you make of the guys who don't want that ball in that moment?
Well, the guys who don't want that moment or the ball in that moment are guys that don't practice those situations. The one thing that I was always meticulous about is in the game scenarios, coming out of timeouts, like ending games, where's everybody going to be? What are we going to figure it out? And I learned this because I had good coaches that made sure that we focused on the small little minute details of the game. And so for me, what I focused on was you got to make free throws and you got to put yourself in a situation where you can make a three that you're not standing still because somebody's rushing out on you. So you got to practice that routine every single day.
Ray Allen joining us. He's a member of the Hall of Fame. He's got a book out too. Ray, I feel like when you and I talked years ago, we talked about your routine, and it is the pregame routine especially is the stuff of legend. Mark Cuban said that whenever you came to town, he would go to the gym early just to watch you go through your pregame routine. How did that routine come about and why was that so important to you?
At first, I would be on the floor. I remember my first year, I would just be out there just kind of messing around. And Chris Ford actually yanked my chain a little bit. And he said, young fella, you just don't do anything. You don't have a routine. You just are just kind of fluttering around. And so what happened was I took Michael Curry and Elliot Perry, and we developed a routine where the three of us figured out the time that we can get to the floor where there was nobody else out on the floor. We can go out and just shoot, be on the floor and off the floor before anybody else came in, because we used to always early, we'd have big guys up there shooting shots, and we were like, we couldn't focus. So we found a good time to get there and get our shots up and be off the floor and be prepared. And then as they moved on and I was by myself, it's just something I just crafted over time, that I just started figuring out how to shoot. If I had the guy to rebound for me, if I was in there by myself, a lot of times I'd shoot in gyms where there was no lights. You know, sometimes I had to borrow clothes because my trainer wasn't there yet. So I was just prepared for all things, but I would never let anybody stop me from getting my shots up.
Hall of Famer Ray Allen joining us. Ray, something that comes up in your book a number of times is the first time you saw Michael Jordan on TV against the Knicks. What was it about the way that he played that had such an impact on you?
Well, I learned that the game was more than just, playing basketball, shooting the ball, putting it in the hoop. He played with such a grace and flair that he could make shots. I remember he kind of went to the hole and he took the contact and he put the ball up behind his head and hit it off the glass. It was like, how did he know what a basket was?
Hmm.
How did he know how to just get through everybody the way he did? And I saw how he took the game and he played it on another level from what everybody else was playing. And I wondered, could I ever get to that level of playing?
Ray Allen's got a book out. It's called From the Outside, My Journey Through Life and the Game I Love. That book is out right now. You know, Ray, you came into the league and you went through some seasons where there was not a lot of winning. And then, of course, you go to Boston and you join Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce. The three of you had been through a lot of losing in your career. So how did that impact the way you approached the challenge in Boston?
Well, we knew when we got to Boston, we weren't focused on who was going to lead the team in scoring or who was going to shoot the last second shot. We were mainly focused on winning. It wasn't about all-star games or contracts. We had been through that phase in our lives where you needed extra touches. Why didn't I get the ball at the end of the game? Or, just the small little minute details that you focus on that make you somewhat of a young, selfish, immature player. But when we got to Boston, it was like, all that stuff, okay, let's get rid of all that. Like, we're not worried about that. We just want to win. And whatever it takes for us to win, we're going to do it, and we're going to do it every single night.
All right, so if you guys all come together and you're all about the right stuff and it works, but then you win a championship, then you have that success that you're all grinding so hard for, once you get that, how hard is it then to keep it all together and try and come back and repeat? Does winning change people?
Winning certainly changes people because typically you want more. You've proven that you can do your job and you should get paid more. There's a contract that somebody's playing for, or you're a young player and you want to make the all-star team. Now you start looking at individual goals that you can accomplish amidst what we're doing as a team. And ultimately, for every team out there, no matter what level you play at, if you win one year and you have an opportunity to win next, that's probably the hardest thing you have to deal with is the expectation of the players. And it's a great coach that could manage those expectations going into that next year where you get everybody to go back. It's like, ask a player to improve himself but still play into your role that you played the previous year and improve that role.
And everything's dynamic, right? Everything changes. And speaking of dynamic, I mean, Ray, as great as it was to win there, the dynamic between the members of the 08 Celtics championship team has been a bit unusual, to say the least. And as you've said, there has been some vitriol directed at you from the guys who you regarded as brothers. I know you've talked about this, Ray, so I won't belabor the point, but as you look back, what was that whole experience like for you as a person?
It was tough as a person because, bonds are created in this game. Friendships are crafted, families grow because you take on, family members of other teammates and their siblings and their mothers and their grandfathers. You get to know them very well. And then to see that change just because you move teams is disappointing. So, for me, you just have to move on because for us, it's how do we continue to move forward and grow? And like, and I think most people do know, like, the game of sports, it's a professional business, and we have to move on, and you got to move to the next team and figure out how to get better and ultimately win a championship. If that's hopefully should be your goal.
It is a business, and I would even argue, Ray, that there really is almost no loyalty in professional sports. And if there is, it's very, very rare. So in your personal experience, Ray, when you see bonds like that that are broken, generally do they get repaired, or once they break, is that it, and does everybody just move on?
Well, I always say anger is a tough emotion to control. You can have the gift of anger. You use the anger that you have, and you use it as a force to make your life better because you want to improve on things, but not to prove that you're right because it's not a right or wrong situation. But you learn from it, and you grow, and you figure out, okay, in certain situations I was probably immature, and, I shouldn't have been mad at this person. I should have learned from them. And that's a lot of what my relationship growth has been over the course of my time in my life. And so now I can sit here as a grown man, having written this book, that there's so many people that I learned from, good and bad, that ultimately made me who I was, ultimately end up winning championships. So it all takes the person's growth, their personal growth, their maturity to say, what was I mad about? Like, if we were playing a game, what was the big deal?
We're talking to Ray Allen. Ray, as you look over your career, and you and I can go on and on and on and on, there's so many areas of your career that we could talk about because it was an amazing career, and this is a great book you've written. Let me finally ask you this. I could ask you about any of your other teammates, but I have to ask you about one of my all-time favorites, Sam Cassell. What was it like to play with Sam Cassell and spend time with Sam?
Well, it's funny that you say that because he's one of my favorite teammates, because Sam, the ultimate competitor, any young player that came into the league, you just thought you had the best, you can get the best of him because he wasn't athletic. You didn't look at him and you weren't intimidated by him. But Sam was, he was a competitor. He was a player. Like, he was so crafty around the basket. He had a great mid-range game. He could shoot the three if he was out there. His post-up game was tougher than anybody's. And so no matter what was happening in the game, he always felt like he had an opportunity to win. And that was the thing that I admired most, because I've been around a lot of players that would give up on you because, the game was over. But Sam would always keep fighting. And then he had great character. Like, he had great charisma. Like, he could talk to anybody. And he always had this exuberance for the game and for life. And that's something I always appreciate about him.
From loser golf dorks who mainline the sport to fringe fans who really otherwise couldn't give a damn. And why is that? Because the field is deep. The field is wide open. There are about 15 different guys who could win this thing. Oh, and one more thing. Taunt is back.
I feel great. I feel like I've really put a lot of the pieces together. I feel fantastic. It's just a matter of now going out there and competing and playing and posting numbers.
Sounded for a minute like the guy was going to go Jeff in San Antonio. I thought he was going to start crying. Tiger! All right, so let me start right there. Because to me, there's no bigger question heading into tomorrow, especially after Elk said that the Cat was going to win on our podcast. Biggest question heading into tomorrow, does the Cat have his big stick ironed out? Yes, there are a grip of other storylines, but none bigger than that. Because as good as Elgato has looked since coming back from the Fusion kiosk, his driver has looked that bad. Don't believe me? Go ask the homeowner who lives off 16 at Bay Hill. Now, word on the street is that Eldrick has been on the range the last couple of weeks solely focusing on dialing in the bazooka. And in yesterday's practice round, he did eagle the two back nine par fives. It's a good sign. It's a very good sign, except Tuesdays are not Sundays. Hell, Tuesdays aren't even Thursdays. This guy's got to do it when it counts. But he thinks he can. Elk thinks he can. The gambleholics in Vegas think that he can.
A lot of gambleholics out there.
I hate to be this guy, he's already won guy, but he's already won. Not the tournament, but the comeback. Because this was a guy who was dropping off ghost-written autobiographies at the pro shop this time last year. And in less than 24 hours, he's going to go off as one of the legitimate favorites to win the whole thing. No, I am not picking him to win. But I'd be shocked if he's not making noise on the weekend, which is something I thought that I would never say again, much less in a tournament like that. So he's going to be a factor. He's going to figure, and it's going to be good for golf. I hope it happens. I'm pulling for the guy. I can't pick the guy, but I'm pulling for the guy because he's got everybody hyped up. Then you've got the hefty lefty, Phil Mickelson. One green sport code shy of joining a very exclusive club of being a four-time winner. Tiger, Jack, Arnie. And at 47, he would be the oldest dude ever to rip a jacket. Now, it has been a half a decade since he won a major, but it's only been a half a month since he won a tournament.
It's been a fun start to the year. It's been a lot of fun getting back in the winner's circle in Mexico. More than that, it's been fun getting in contention, having opportunities to win and competing at the highest level week in and week out. So winning was a big thing for me, especially heading into this week.
More than that, it's been fun listening to Elk talk about Hefty. It's impossible to count this guy out, though. He's been here before. He's won here before. He's playing some of his better golf in recent memory. Now, I don't think Hefty is going to win, but his name on the leaderboard could get some of the young guns to squirt the sandwich, so to speak.
They're going to squirt the sandwich out the back. I mean, it's not going to happen.
So to me, he's more of an agent of chaos this week than he is a winner. Then there's DJ. If DJ could somehow avoid racking himself on a two-step set of stairs between now and tomorrow, we're going to see the world number one tee off at Augusta for the first time since 2016. Now, you already know this guy can hit it a mile, and he's got a wedge game and a better flat stick these days. But don't forget, he's been garbage at the Masters over his career. Seven tourneys, 28 rounds, and two over par to show for it. He might be the world number one, but that ranking is not going to mean jack this week. Not when the track has gotten the better of you nearly every single time that you peg it up there. You take Dustin Johnson, I will take your money. Probably not a guy who loves Augusta more than Jordan Spieth. 24 years old, four starts there, and all he's done is go second, first, second, 11th.
It's my favorite tournament in the world. I've certainly made that pretty clear going back the last 5 years, so excited for this week. I feel better coming into this week than I did in 16 and 14.
You know how good you have to be at a certain track to finish in 11th and have that be like some kind of catastrophe? Like it's terrible? And don't give me that crap that he's yipped up from that 2016 collapse. He hasn't. He's fine. He ripped three tourneys. He went and ripped three tourneys and a British Open after that. So this guy's fine. And the track suits his game like no other. I love Jordan to be there on Sunday. Not enough to pick him, but I do like him. Now, the only dude with more pressure than Taunt to get it done this week is Rory McIlroy, the heir apparent to the swoosh. And everybody knows this is the one major he needs to finish off that mantle. All that pressure to finally break through at Augusta is amplified now that he's coming off a win at Bay Hill, where he played his best golf in a year and a half. Can he replicate it this week? Can Rory get it done? Is he the guy to beat? Not if you ask me. I'm not picking him.
I feel like I'm coming in here in great form and, you know, excited to have another chance to try and win this great tournament. Excited for the week. Feel like, you know, I couldn't come in here with better form. It was great to get a win a couple of weeks ago. And you know, hopefully I can just carry that golf forward for the next few days.
It's not the first time I've heard that from him. In fact, when has he not felt great? Pulling into Magnolia Lane. Yeah, pretty much every single time, and every single time he peels out with no jacket to show for it, and I don't think that's going to change in 2018. Thanks to Sergio finally winning a major after like 400 years on tour, Ricky Fowler now has to wear the gloss, best to never win one. Not a good spot to be, not a fun spot to be, but it's where he's been living for about a year now. Truth is, Rick is not bringing in any kind of significant momentum this week. He might be the guy that can just show up and get it done. His best asset is his putter. Even that looks a little wobbly right now. Yeah, I can't pick him. Did I miss anybody? Am I forgetting anybody? Is there anybody that I've forgotten? I got to pick somebody, right? Oh, wait. Justin freaking Thomas, captain of my arch rival team, Creamy Peanut Butter. Now, this kid, he's fresh off his best year of his golfing life. He's already bagged a Honda Classic to jumpstart 2018. No one has been better for the past 18 months. No one looks more poised to get measured for sleeves this week. I love the kid. I love his game. More importantly, I love the mental makeup of a 24-year-old who has experienced so much winning at such a young age?
Man, I love this place so much. It's a great, great golf course. It just requires a very strong mental week. You need to be mentally sharp. You need to not make any stupid mistakes out there. If you get in trouble, make sure you get out and take advantage of the opportunities that you have.
I'm telling you, this guy's not afraid. He's a killer. He's a finisher. He's not afraid of the moment. He's got a wanna-maker to prove it too. But then again, why make a prediction when I don't have to? I mean, if I'm right, I don't get any credit. If I'm wrong, I won't hear the end of it. So why do it? Because it's Justin Jungle Thomas. That's why. He's been a favorite around here. He's been in multiple times. He's got a back pocket full of karma. So I'm going to put myself out there for the Kentucky kid. Give me a JT to get fitted for the jacket. Give me JT to win the Masters. Yeah, no, I'm not putting myself way out there, but I am picking somebody, and it's not Taunt, and it's not Hefty. BYU head coach Kalani Sitake is my guest. Kalani, so good to have you back. How are you? Good morning.
Doing great. Thank you for having me on, Jim.
It's good to have you back. So as I mentioned off the top, you've got your spring scrimmage coming up on Saturday. But before we get into some of the details, how has spring practice been going, and what are you looking to see from your team on Saturday?
It's been going really well. I mean, I think every head coach would tell you that right now, you know, in spring. But for what we're trying to accomplish and with installing a new offense and trying to get some young guys in the mix, I think it's been really good competition. And we've been really physical, probably more physical this spring than I've ever had. I mean, we made our quarterbacks live in four scrimmages. And so I'll probably make them live again this Saturday. So it'll be a lot of fun, and we can see how these guys perform it when they get in front of a crowd.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the physicality this year and this spring. What was the thinking behind increasing that physicality?
Well, I need to know how guys are going to respond in a game. And I think a quarterback is a tough position. Obviously, you know, it's so specialized. But I think guys tend to get complacent a little bit, knowing that they're just getting touched and they wear a different color jersey. Our guys still wear a different color jersey, but when we're going live, they have to get tackled, and we have a lot of quarterbacks, and I think we can kind of baby them too much, and so I need to see how guys respond, especially when it's live. And trust me, these quarterbacks, they're excited for it. They hate getting touched and saying that they're down, and it actually helps our defense be able to secure sacks and make plays, and it's more like real football now when the quarterback's live.
Kalani Sitake joining us. No, I've seen that. They've said they like it. They like it a lot. You know, I wonder, there's got to be a balance though, right? I mean, you want these guys to get hit and you want them to be tough, but at the same time, you don't want them to wear down. You don't want them to get hurt. So when you try and walk that line, how exactly do you go about getting the balance that you need that they get the hitting in, but you're not getting guys busted up?
Well, I think being really selective on how you do it, and then we're able to get better matchups, but it's also allowing the quarterbacks to be smart and know the matchups on defense. I mean, our guys know if there's a new tackle there and how quick they got to get the ball out. I just think it creates more urgency for them to perform better, and I'm okay with it. I think it's, for me, I mean, I'm saying that now with none of our quarterbacks really getting hurt, but I think for us, the trade-off of being physical and having guys alive, it's now I go into the season knowing what I have, you know, and I'd rather have that and learn that now rather than do it and cost us in the season. And, after last year, we don't have any time to really feel things out. We have to be good now. And, I think talking with our coaching staff, and Coach Grimes is our offensive coordinator and Coach Sviaki is our DC, we thought this would be good for the team overall, and it's been really nice to have our guys go live, and it's been a lot of excitement. But there's been some close calls and some scary moments, but that's football, you know, and I think that's when you do that, spring becomes more important for these young men, and it's a lot harder now because you can't hide. And not just talking about the quarterbacks, but these D linemen, they have to finish the play and make a sack, and it's requiring everyone to play fall type of football in spring, and that's what we need to simulate.
Kalani Sitake joining us, the head coach at BYU. You know, it's no secret that last season did not go the way you would have liked. When you come in and you win 9 games, including a bowl game in your first season, and then you have a season like you did last year, how have you gone about dealing with that? For instance, do you throw the thing out the window and move forward, or do you try to go to school on what happened last year and learn from that?
Well, I think I took the same approach after the first year. I mean, although we went 9-4, there were some close games that I really thought we could have done better, you know, and Obviously, this year I know we could have done better. And so first thing I do is I look at myself and I see, okay, as a head coach, what am I doing that is causing this and what can I change? And so I don't believe in just hoping that things get better. I want to take the initiative and jump on it right away. You know, sometimes it's not the most popular thing when you do that, but I only know one way, and that's to work. And so as we get going on this next term, I mean, I think we did things differently from the first year to the second year, and we sure as heck are doing it differently now in the third year, and that I'm okay with that. You know, I think that if you were just to hope and hope something happens or we get a special player to come in and make things happen for you, then we're going to get in trouble. And our fan base deserves more than that. And so my obligation is first to these players and to our fan base and to providing a better product. And that's what I try to get done this offseason, and that's what I'm trying to focus on right now for the fall.
And then you open up the season at Arizona. Then you follow that up with a game against Cal and then Wisconsin. It's a tough, challenging way to start the year. But at the same time, when you have challenges like that right out of the gate, does that serve as a way to focus everybody during the offseason? Is that part of the thinking?
Of course. And everything at BYU is hard. Our players live to a different standard. You know, we have an honor code that we abide by. We play the game differently. We have older guys that are a little bit more mature, and I expect our guys to play with a lot of class and sportsmanship, but also be physical. And so it requires a special type of players and special types of recruits. And so, you know, I expect our guys to be able to get it done. And so why not have a hard schedule to complement what we're doing already in life? You know, our guys are living college life different than most other college football players right now, and I'm okay with that, you know. And that's what we're going to highlight. And instead of wishing for something to be better, just focus on what makes us great, and that's that we're unique, and things are hard here, and then things are going to be hard. We have a tough schedule, which will match what our life is all about, and we're going to focus on discipline and try to get better and highlight the things that make us great.
BYU head football coach Klonius talking, my guest. You know, one of the things I look forward to and I enjoy about our conversations is when you come on, we frequently take a step away from football and we talk about life. So with that in mind, I want to bring up a talk that you had recently, and in particular, a story that you told about when you were a child. Your parents were divorced when you were six, and as you said, it was a really challenging time for you. But at one point, a group of BYU football players came to your elementary school and talked to the students about health. Afterwards, one of them came up and he talked to you. What do you remember about that moment?
It was a conversation that changed my life, you know, and he just saw that I was off on the side. I wasn't really involved with the recess. The players were playing recess with us, and I thought that he came over and just saw that I was hurting, you know, and came in and had a minute conversation that really didn't matter much to him, but it changed my life. He told me that everything would be fine and that God loves me, right? And so those words, I heard everything will be fine probably a million times, but that's the first time I actually believed it. And I was 9 years old at the time. And I knew from that moment I was going to play football for BYU. And so it gave me a purpose and it gave me direction. And it was from a perfect stranger, you know, and someone that I idolized. So in order for me to be a football coach and to do it the right way, I think we have to use this platform to make the world better and try to change people's lives, because I'm living proof that it could work, you know, and it could happen. And in a time where there's not a lot of eye-to-eye contact and human interaction, I think it's important for us to get out there and help each other. And there's things that are going on in the community and that could be better. And I think that takes everyone communicating and talking. And I'm proof that a minute conversation can change somebody's life. So if there's people out there that you can just a smile, a kind gesture, a conversation, a hug, you know, could change someone's life, and I'm living proof of that. I know there's others out there that are hurting, that we could really make a difference, and that's what I'm trying to focus on as a coach. And I have to win football games. That's my job as a coach. But I'm not only defined by that. I there's other things that are there that make me tick, and I live for, and that's making the world better and trying to help people, because I'm proof that if someone just loves people, that life can get better.
I said you were six, but you were nine. But what an absolutely amazing story that is, that your entire life changed in that moment. I mean, maybe it's tough to say with certainty, but if that moment does not happen, are you and I having this conversation right now? Are you the head football coach at BYU if that conversation back then didn't happen?
Probably not, you know. And then my parents divorced when I was six, but
okay.
It was 9 years old that this conversation happened. So for 3 years, I was struggling with things. And then this conversation helped me, you know. So probably not, but, you know, there's a lot of other mentors and people that have helped. If you take a step back, Jim, and you look at your own life and list the people that helped and sacrificed for you, I mean, I'm living proof and I'm the product of other people's hard work and sacrifice, and so are you, right?
For sure.
And so that's how it works. That's what life is all about. And it's not just because I coach football, because I played football. It's because I was able to get out there and meet with people, and it's because this player affected my life, and it's such a huge positive for me, and he was a stranger.
So with the impact that those players had on you when you were a kid, what kind of things do you tell your current players about the impact they can have on everybody that they come in contact with?
Oh yeah, that's what we focus on. And I have to be honest, when I got here to BYU, first of all, the student athletes here are amazing when it comes to service and helping other people, especially young people. And so they just bought into it. I shared my experience with the players, and they all get it, you know. And I've been really proud of the stuff that we did on the field. Obviously, wasn't good enough. We didn't win enough games. But I can tell you right now, the way our players reacted during that season and through the tough times, I'm actually really excited about what we're going to do this year, because I saw them do things. And it's easy to be humble when you're winning, right? It's hard to do it when things aren't going your way. And my players, these guys on this team, they were raised by the right people, and they're such great examples to everyone in carrying themselves with class and dignity and being able to respect others and still love and serve. And that makes me extremely proud as a coach, and I'm really excited about that transforming onto the field for us.
You know, what a great message. What a great reminder for all of us. Before I let you go, let me circle all the way back to your quarterback situation. Before I let you go, you know, the thinking is outside Kalani looking in that you've got a real quarterback battle on your hands, and the freshman Zach Wilson is going to be a big part of that. A few months ago, this guy was still in high school. Now he's in the conversation to be a starter in September. How impressed have you been with the way he's gone about his work?
Been really impressed with him, and that's what we saw in recruiting him. And you know, I have to give a lot of credit to Coach Grimes as our offensive coordinator and Aaron Roderick as our quarterbacks coach and developing him. And I got to be honest with you, the other best part about it is that the mentors that he's receiving is in his position group. Bo Hodge, Tanner Mangum, Joe Crisell, all these guys are working together to make each other better. And it's nice when you're competing against each other, but it's really nice when you know that they have your back and they really want you to succeed. And so our guys really want to win the spot. They're not wishing bad things on others. They're just trying to make everyone great. And in doing so, it's created this competition that everyone's getting better. And he's a huge benefactor of that, you know. And that he was a great player to begin with. So I know having him here is really good with us. But having a freshman that's getting ready to go to prom in a week or so, you know, be able to run with the ones and then feel confidence enough to be around the team, it goes because they're coaching and the culture that they're providing, and then also the leadership on our team and the guys welcoming him into the family. So it's going to be exciting, and I think that's just one position, but I'm seeing great competition in all the positions on our team.
All right, and then finally, since you mentioned your coaches, coming out last season, you did make some changes to the coaching staff. So what do you make of how the new guys have fit in so far and how the players are responding to the new coaches?
Great, great coaches. They have a lot of experience. They know what they're doing. And you know, I lean heavily on Coach Grimes being able to hire staff, and I've been really pleased with the way that they're doing it. And just great control in the position groups. Now, I say that with a lot of respect for the guys that were here before, because they put in a lot of hard work in the last 2 years. So I respect Coach Detmer and all the other coaches that did their work here. And I those guys are my friends. I love them. You know, wasn't an easy thing to do, but I'm really pleased with the direction our offense is going, and pleased with the coaches and the way they're working together. But more important, I'm just really happy with the way that they're connecting with our players and getting the most out of them.
Good night now!